I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. Last Thursday, the commissioner released a plan to reduce crime and transform his beleaguered department, improving data collection and analysis to get smarter about where and how to deploy officers and reducing the time it takes them to respond to serious situations. The plan also calls for technology upgrades and closer partnerships with other city agencies and community stakeholders. Hopes for Mr. Harrison have been high since he arrived in Baltimore in February. Will his plan turn the tide of violence in our city and put us on a trajectory that includes confidence in a department that's been racked by scandal and which remains under a federal consent decree? Baltimore Police Commissioner Michael Harrison joins me here in Studio A when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining me on Midday today. Today, my guest here in Studio A is the new-ish Police Commissioner of Baltimore City, Michael Harrison. He was appointed by then-Mayor Catherine Pugh in January of this year, approved by the City Council a few weeks later, and sworn into office in March. Last Thursday, flanked by Mayor Jack Young and other city officials, Commissioner Harrison unveiled his plan to address the crime problem that has afflicted Baltimore in particularly acute ways since the riots and unrest that followed the death of Freddie Gray in 2015. It addresses response times by police, where and how they are deployed throughout the city, technology needs, and how police can build cases that hold up in court for people accused of serious crimes while exploring alternatives to jail for those who commit lesser offenses. The commissioner is with us for the hour today. We'll begin by start taking your calls, in about 20 minutes. For now, you are welcome to submit your questions and comments via email, text, and Facebook. Our email is 410-662-8780. That's my phone number. You can get online for the phone, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @midday WYPR, and we are streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. Commissioner, it's good to see you, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So the plan talks about transforming two things, transforming the crime rate, the reducing crime, and transforming the department. You've also talked about how we have to transform the culture of the street, for lack of a better term. This weekend, 9 people shot, 2 fatally. I would assume that transforming the culture in New Orleans was part of the success that you enjoyed there. When we talk about young people, often men of color, mostly men of color, resorting to violence and gun violence in particular to settle disputes and et cetera. So were there things that happened in New Orleans to change the culture of the street that you think can be duplicated here?
I do. First of all, thank you for that, and thank you for having me. I do believe there are lessons learned that can be duplicated and or replicated here. And it is really the culture of violence where young men are choosing handguns to solve their own conflicts. And that is a culture, a learned behavior that has been here for a long time. It was in New Orleans for a long time. But it is really reaching out to them to make sure we can offer people a pathway away from a life of violence and being able to deliver on that, which was a very comprehensive violence reduction strategy there called NOLA for Life. We hope to replicate parts of that here, but also having strong enforcement and strong consequences for those who are committing these really violent acts as individuals and as groups, and having a very systematic way of identifying who they are and going after them when they don't accept the help to move away from a life of crime. And so we believe that can work here also, but it really requires an investment to offer people opportunities with interventions and preventions and those who need rehabilitation work and those who are coming out of jail. We want to make sure we can deliver on a promise to give them a pathway away so that they either don't get involved in it or don't return to it. But at the same time, having strong consequences, because young men are solving their conflicts through this violent way because they think they can, and they think they can get away with it, and that is their core belief. And so through their families and through the faith-based community and through the academic and core institutions, we really have to drive change in the culture of why people even make those decisions, because policing alone will not do it. It's a premeditated thing in their mind about how they want to solve their conflicts.
Last time you were here, we talked about, you know, that decision that a young man might make to leave the house with a gun.
Absolutely. The decision, and you remember that, that's great. The decision to use a gun or pull the trigger, it is not made when the trigger is pulled. It is made long before when the individual chooses to walk out of the door with the gun, because they've predisposed in their minds and predetermined to themselves that if they need it, they have it and will use it. And because they're such poor conflict resolution skills and lack of consequences, or the perception of the lack of consequences, they think they can do it and get away with it. So that's how they choose to solve the conflicts. Now, it's usually done out of the absence of police. So, you know, wherever we put police, they're usually doing it away from the police. And when they're encountering people that they have these ongoing feuds with, some of those feuds date back years, some even decades. And so we really have to address the change in the culture in the community, as well as the change in the culture in the police department, about how efficient and effective we want to be and how much time we really need to spend being visible to deter crime, highly engage with the community through community engagement to build trust and legitimacy that people will trust us to even provide the very information we need to hold these people accountable. All of that has to be done at the same time.
So when you talk about cultural transformation of the department itself, as I mentioned, we're under a consent decree, which has, you know, been in place now for a while. How do you assess the progress so far, not just in satisfying the requirements of the consent decree, but your assessment, your gut about how the culture of the department has changed in the 5 or 6 months you've been here?
I believe it is changing. It's slow, but I see it because I see it every day. And it's hard for people in the community or outside of our department to see it. But slowly, the leadership paradigm is shifting and people are beginning to see the need for high levels of management performance and supervisory accountability. And so we're slowly transforming the department by teaching people how to hold each other and hold ourselves accountable at every level, good policy creation, good training and implementation of those policies through training and deployment, and then teaching members of our department about smart deployment strategies. But it's really about what I call accountability-driven leadership that I learned from my predecessor, who was the chief before me in New Orleans. And it's really about accountability-driven leadership with performance metrics to make sure we're performing to standard. But when we don't perform, what are the accountability measures to hold people accountable when we don't? And so it is all of that, both in policy creation, which is in writing, and in performance. And we have to do both.
What's a reasonable expectation for a time frame as to when you are going to be fully satisfied that a real major 180-degree change in the culture of the department has occurred?
Well, it's slow. I'm beginning to see it now, but I'm beginning to see it at the leadership level. And I think when it manifests itself, you know, with the troops who are actually executing our plan on the ground level, and then citizen satisfaction reports begin to come in to show that citizens are beginning to see a different police department, I think that will be the first measure that the tide is turning and the ship is turning. And it really will come from the citizens, because the measurement of consent decree compliance is really in the practice that we have in the field. Is the policy turning into good training, and is the training turning into good practice? In the field. And when that happens, citizens notice it, the officers themselves notice it, and we start seeing fewer incidents of uses of force, fewer complaints made by citizens about bad acts committed by police, increased citizen satisfaction about the experience with police, whether in a police station or at their home or on a traffic stop or wherever. And when we see that to occur, I think a year from now, we'll start seeing citizens' surveys come out and satisfaction reports. But right now, what people can see that I've already seen, and I think many members of our communities are starting to see it, is just better visibility. More officers patrolling, more officers getting out of the cars on foot patrols, more engagement, whether it's the community walks that we go on in the VRI zones every Wednesday or just other community engagement initiatives you see the officers on now. It's more visibility and more engagement. I think that's beginning to manifest itself now. I'm getting preliminary reports from neighborhood associations that people see that. Now, can that translate later into crime reduction? is the ultimate goal, which we're working towards.
Over the last few months, I've probably talked to maybe 36 cops on the street. Anytime I see a cop, I ask them two questions. What do they think about you? And what do they think about the consent decree? You'll be happy to know that every time I ask somebody about you, they have a smile on their face and they're optimistic, right?
Thank you.
When I ask them about the consent decree, they tend to look at their shoes, you know, and they don't have a whole lot to say about that. Well, how do you assess your personal relationship with the FOP, for example, who, you know, continues to be somewhat critical about even some of the new strategies that you've outlined in this plan, complaining routinely about shortages of officers, you know, in the force itself, which is an assessment you probably share. But that relationship with the people under your command is really important. In these first few months of your tenure, how do you think it's going?
Well, I think the relationship with the rank and file of the police department, I think it's going well. I'm spending time every week going to roll calls in the evening and even late at night. I try to do 3 or 4 a week. Excuse me. And I've been doing that on a consistent basis to hear directly from the rank and file, to tell them what it is that we're doing, to let them see me and touch me and hear from me. But it allows me to hear from them. And so I'm hearing it directly from them, what the needs are. And I see what the needs are, but I'm letting them tell me and get it off their chest what they think is working with the department, what's not working, and what they're asking for and looking for in a leader, and that I'm able to answer any of their questions. So I think that's going very fine. And, you know, the FOP is a labor organization that represents the men and women of the department. I think we have a professional relationship, though they may be critical of many things, and I get that. And I think from both my professional and my personal experience of being a chief now, 5 years in 2 major cities, you know, I represent both the men and women of the department and the community we serve, and I'm an advocate for both. And so while the FOP represents individual officers or collective groups of individuals, I represent the organization and every single member of the organization. I am their spokesperson, and I am their leader, and I hear directly from them. And though there's sometimes, you know, criticisms about policies or criticisms about decisions, the decisions are always in favor of the organization and not in favor of any one person or any collective groups of individuals.
My guest is Commissioner Michael Harrison, the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department. He officially started the job on the 2nd of March. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. With this new plan, what did you assess as the deficits in the approach to crime fighting in previous administrations?
I think some of the deficits in my assessment there's certainly a some policy deficits. There are some deployment deficits. There's certainly a manpower shortage. I think we all agree about the manpower shortage, but let me be clear, it is very different to say that we are short X amount of officers and saying we have X fewer officers, because we are in a very archaic paper environment, and part of the plan is to move us into a digital environment with the onset of new technology that moves us away from handwriting, paper documents, you know, which should have been done away 20 years ago.
Yeah, the report talked about having to also drive back to the station those reports.
There are technology deficiencies that I think are 20, 25 years behind the curve of many well-functioning police departments, which we hope in very short order and quickly to bring our department up. And so there's some policy and some technology deficiencies that were really clear. Manpower was a deficiency, and some of the deployment and use of the manpower, the way our people were deployed. And so now we're bringing in the, you know, national best practices on how to deploy using data and intelligence-led policing data on where to be, when to be there, and with whom we should be interacting based on the data that identifies the small subset of individuals committing the most violence and where and when. And so now we've moved to that level of deployment. Despite the manpower shortage, we can be more efficient and effective with what we have while we recruit and retain the good officers that are here with us.
In terms of a comprehensive approach, people have used that term, that rhetoric now for a long time. Mayor Pugh talked about a comprehensive report. Your 2 or 3 predecessors that I've had on this show talk about this comprehensive approach. is this comprehensive, holistic approach that you're talking about in this plan, does it differ substantially from what the department's been doing in the past? Can you point to things that are, you know, really brand new paths that you're going to be exploring that haven't been explored in the past?
Well, I think I can't speak for what previous administrations did here, although I know a little bit about it. I can't speak really about what they did. What I see as a deficiency is, in addition to enforcement, we can increase our effectiveness and our efficiency by making sure we're going out having high levels of engagement, producing the best possible cases to bring to our prosecutor to prosecute that don't get this, rejected or refused by the state's attorney or dismissed from court in some way, or plea bargained down because they're not strong, winnable cases. That's number one. Number two, the comprehensive approach that brings in the help to offer young men opportunities and a pathway away from crime. There are many, many great people and programs in Baltimore. My assessment is that they're not well coordinated and collaborated with good communication. And they certainly don't do that with the city. And it's not pulled together under one umbrella with performance metrics to really know that everything's working. And we know every organization's capacity every day.
So the police role in that is to direct people to resources or to create the resources yourself?
Not to create the resources ourselves and to some degree to direct, but to work in conjunction with the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice, who will oversee this, but to make sure that there are programs that are there to help people and the way to really reduce violence and people who are using violence and committing violence is to give them what they need, which is usually education, housing, and mental health abuse and drug abuse help and skills and jobs that pay a good wage and sometimes even housing for relocation. And how do we do that and deliver on that promise? That will be run out of the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice. But I guess my point is there are many people who provide those services. They're not well organized to work with each other and to work with the city. And so now we want to build an umbrella that really connects and coordinates and collaborates with all of those social service providers so that along with enforcement for our bad actors, there are opportunities. And so for every person who would be a victim that we could move away, that's one fewer victim, which means there could be one fewer perpetrator. And so it's really a comprehensive approach. And so while I'm the champion of it, it's going to be run out of the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice.
And then in that sense, it's not a part of the police department budget either.
That is correct.
Baltimore City's Police Commissioner Michael Harrison is my guest today here in Studio A. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll try to take some of your calls and comments. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. We are streaming live as we speak. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation about race and the meaning of racism. Given President Trump's recent brutish and racist tweets and statements last week and the reaction or lack thereof that they engendered in the public square, what should we make of the fact that the duly elected leader of our country is more than comfortable laying bare his conviction that people of color are less capable and less desirable than white people? The "go back where you came from" taunt is one in a long, long series of demeaning comments aimed at non-white people and part of a deliberate strategy to speak to those white voters who hold people of color in the same contempt as the president does. We're going to talk about it tomorrow with our panel and you here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Baltimore City Police Commissioner Michael Harrison. He has led the city's police department since March. Last Thursday, he released a plan to reduce crime and transform the police department over the next several years. We've got a link to the plan on our website. Give it a look and let us know what you think. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And you can also change us or catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Commissioner, we have a number of calls. Before we get to some of those, When it comes to deployment, you talked about changing the strategy of deployment. Just last Monday, and this is anecdotal, it's not, you know, it should be taken for what it's worth. Just a couple blocks from here at this clinic on Maryland Avenue, there was a police-involved shooting. The officer who was injured in that incident has been released from the hospital, we're happy to say. But two people died, including the shooter. About an hour later, in front of Johns Hopkins University, there was an armed carjacking. And about an hour after that, on Fenchurch Road in Guilford, there was an armed robbery. These are in the middle of the day. A lot of folks used to say, well, you know, the violence in Baltimore, it's contained within these same high-risk, high-crime, low-economic areas of the city. There's a lot of folks who are saying that's no longer the case now. We're talking about Charles Village, around Johns Hopkins University, even in Guilford, one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city. There is this assumption, you know, that the bad neighborhoods was where all this stuff was taking place. And now there's this perception that that's no longer the case. How does a deployment strategy address that?
Well, great question. Our deployment strategy has actually, even before we changed it, been fairly robust and fairly good, because we are actually, outside of these individual cases of armed robberies that have taken place in very unconventional areas, all of our crime indicators have us trending down in all of the categories, including armed robberies and carjackings all over the city. So year to date, we're actually down in armed robbery and in all the categories, with the exceptions of shootings and murders. Now, the deployment strategy we looked at for the new creation of a deployment into what we call micro zones was based on three crime categories: murders, non-fatal shootings, and armed robberies. And we looked at 5 years of historical data to tell us where they were occurring. Historically, they were in, you know, certain neighborhoods that showed us that it was a five-year pattern. But what we're seeing is, you know, robbery, unlike shootings and murders, robbery is really a crime of opportunity. And it's individuals now who are becoming extremely brazen, who are leaving the areas we normally over periods of time see them commit armed robberies, moving into other areas where it could be a target-rich environment, where they think they could actually get something, or there are fewer patrols or less visibility, or they actually think they can accomplish it and get away with it because they either don't fear the consequences or consequences don't exist. It's a combination of all of that. It's no one thing, but the deployment strategy that we've come up with now is a 5-year historical data that tells us where these crimes are committing. But part B to that is making sure that when we have good cases and we apprehend the people who are committing these crimes, that we actually tie them to the other crimes they commit and build a good case. Because by taking them off the street and making them accountable, by putting them in jail and keeping them in jail, is how we actually change the culture that it's okay to go out and commit that crime. It is with strong consequences.
One of your deputy commissioners just on Saturday night, Danny Murphy, a gentleman you brought up from New Orleans, he and his wife were walking near Patterson Park, and four guys got out of an SUV and robbed them at gunpoint. Again, is there something other than a deployment strategy? Because that does seem like a kind of random act. That seems like guys were driving around looking for people that, you know, might be rich targets, as you say. I mean, what else besides deployment strategies can help address that kind of thing?
Well, there's target hardening, which is improved lighting, and, you know, people making sure there's no shrubbery or debris or things where criminals could hide in the shadows. And then people want to make sure that they're being, you know, have, you know, spatial awareness of their surroundings. And let me just say, Deputy Commissioner Murphy is a civilian deputy chief, and a lot of people think one of the commission chiefs, or he's a civilian chief. He doesn't carry a gun. He's just a civilian deputy commissioner. And even from talking with him and talking with the investigators, it was a quiet night. He had seen police earlier, but just on a walk home, it was just a quiet, vulnerable time in a vulnerable place. And I think people are, you know, the bad guys are preying on people, but that's why we want to make sure we increase our visibility. That is why this plan is so important, to reduce burdens, to move away work from the officers so we have more free time, to bring in more officers and keep the good officers and build capacity and take some of the work away that has us running from call to call, so we can have an increased presence, so that we can deter and displace much of this and then apprehend people who commit it. But that's why, as you look through that, you see me put a lot of emphasis on burden reductions. How do we create more capacity, more free time, and more manpower?
Let's go to the phones to April in Baltimore. She has a question, I believe, about corruption in the police department. April, welcome to Midday with Commissioner Harrison.
Thank you so much. And I would like to say, Commissioner Harris, you have so many people rooting and praying for your success. So thank you so much for just being here.
Thank you, April.
My question for you is that, and I think I speak for a lot of people, where I've and dangerous work that these officers are out here in the streets doing. However, there are a handful of them, and I really do feel like it's the minority, that are have a power complex, you know, are just, you know, doing things and acting certain ways that don't uphold the integrity and the perception and all the hard work that you and so many other officers are trying to do every day. And that's what's really making it hard for people to engage and help and have a more positive view for police officers. How do you plan to address and or break that brotherhood code of silence where police officers see other officers acting this way and are afraid or, for whatever reason, not saying anything, not turning them in?
Thanks for that good question,
man,
April.
That's a great question, April. April, I'm bringing a program that we created in New Orleans here called EPIC. Now, there are a number of things that we're doing by creating strong policies, stronger training, stronger discipline, and, you know, at every level, not just for the officers, but all the way up to me. But that aside, we are bringing one specific program here called EPIC, Ethical Policing is Courageous. And while we have historically taught officers to de-escalate citizen behavior, when citizens escalate, we're teaching ourselves how to make a citizen de-escalate. EPIC teaches police officers how to de-escalate each other's behavior. So when an officer is escalating to do the bad thing or whatever the thing is, that's going to take us down a path where I'm going to have to lie for you later and we both might get fired or go to jail later. It teaches us how to step in front of each other and say, you know what, don't do that, I'll take over, so that we can help prevent the bad thing from ever happening. And it's a pact that officers make with each other to save their careers by exhibiting loyalty on the front end instead of exhibiting misplaced and misguided loyalty on the back end when we do something wrong by having to cover up for it. And this teaches us to not let the bad thing happening by stepping in front so that I don't have to report you because I kept you from doing the bad thing in the first place. And so that program is coming here in the very near future. So that's just one example. But like I said, it's really about building strong policies, strong training, and strong discipline to make sure people are held accountable. And when supervisors learn and managers learn of it and don't do anything about it, strong discipline for them as well.
One of the things in your plan, top of the list, is increasing response times. You want to get them under 10 minutes for the serious infractions. You talk about place-based and data-driven deployment strategies, these micro zones where you're going to, you know, I guess flood the zone, as we say in football, to make sure that there's people in places where, you know, crimes in the past at least have been likely to occur. The 10-minute rule for response times, are you optimistic that that's an achievable?
I am absolutely optimistic. And surprisingly, the department did not have a response time goal. Now, while we get to calls really quickly on emergency calls anyway, especially when our shot spotter gun detection lets us know shots are being fired from firearms, we're getting there in 2 minutes, a minute or two, in 3 minutes. That's really quick. That's faster than the citizen can pick up the phone and call 911 to get that to us. But we didn't have a goal of a response time. And until you know how fast you want to get to a citizen in an emergency, along with other factors, there's no way to really determine how many officers you really need. You have to have that goal along with other goals to be able to create the mathematical formula to tell you what you need. That's the first goal that we set for ourselves in knowing what size department we really should have based on the technology we have now. And then we will evolve it when we move into a digital environment and away from a paper-based environment and then reassess. But for right now, we really had to set the goal of how fast do we want to get there. And that determines, based on where we know crimes are occurring, how many officers we need working at any given time.
We have a number of folks on the phone, but before we get back to them, I do want to ask you about two things. One, this federal partnership, the National Public Safety Partnership. Baltimore was turned down for that in its first round a year ago. Now it's been accepted. It's one of 10 cities that's working with the federal government. You said that what's different now is that we have the full force and weight of the federal government behind the BPD. How do you think that's going to
I think that's going to work very well. Baltimore applied several years in a row and was denied several years in a row. And we were fortunate to be able to meet with our deputy attorney general a little while ago. And we convinced that our policies comply with federal law. And we were allowed entry into the Public Safety Partnership, which gives us access to shared resources from all of our federal agencies. And it gives us technical support and training to teach us how to get better in many areas. Technology, in training, in deployment, in crime analytics, in CompStat. And so the experts in the country can either be brought to us on the at the government's expense or send us to them to learn to improve out and build capacity within our agency. But it also gives us shared resources, and it makes the federal government and all of its agencies have skin in the game, because they now have to really perform to the performance standards set by the Attorney General, because it's a federal program, but it's a partnership, and it's a wonderful thing. And I think, you know, coming, we were in it in New Orleans for 3 years. New Orleans is coming out, and Baltimore is going in. It was one of the big tools that help us have success there. I'm looking forward to that relationship here.
When State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby comes on and we talk, one of the things that she talks about as a real priority for her office is getting folks in the community more willing to talk about information they have in cases.
Yes.
The stop snitching mentality of many people in many of our neighborhoods. I understand that ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, will actually be paying for information that leads to arrests and drug dealers and felons, et cetera. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about here? I mean, does this federal partnership come with a check, or does it come with expertise?
It comes with expertise. And so this is separate. This was always there and will always be there. This is separate. This is about building capacity, teaching us how to build a better department and how to be more efficient and effective with what we have, and gives us shared resources. So perhaps what we don't have, we can utilize those resources that exist within our federal agencies. And so it brings a lot to bear, but not a check. It teaches us and helps us build more capacity.
Because we have an email from Shay who says, what can you do to make sure people feel safe to speak out and become witnesses? People in all communities are afraid to testify for fear of repercussions.
I got it.
That's a long-standing problem.
That's a long-standing problem here and in many places. And so it becomes the department becoming trustworthy and building police legitimacy and building good products that we turn over to our state's attorney. But it does require citizens to be able to tell us who's committing the harm against them. And the very people who are saying they're afraid to do that are the very people that are being victimized. And so it's a reoccurring cycle. And we need the community's help. But yes, we have to build trust from our department and to make people trust us to know, number one, that we care. Number two, that we actually can do something about it. And then working with the state's attorney and our federal partners to be able to provide some level of comfort, knowing that people won't be retaliated against. But we have to change the culture and hold people accountable when we know that they took though and committed those bad acts as well.
Got to take a break. But before we do, let's go to Herman in Waverly for one more call. Herman, welcome to the show with Commissioner Harrison.
Good afternoon. I figure or fear that most of the perpetrators in the city spent time, their formative years in the city public schools. And my thought is that one way to reduce the crime in this city is to institute a relationship between the police department and the public schools, and possibly to start value of life courses in the public schools.
Well, thanks for that call, Herman.
I think that's a great comment, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. And you know, but that builds a relationship with schools that deals with looking at kids going forward, and that's a measure of prevention, to prevent kids from going down a path of crime. But in addition to that, which we absolutely agree with, is what can we do with people who are committing crime now? and how can we offer them a pathway away from the life that they're in now? Because they need education as well, but they need to jobs that will sustain them and support them now. And how can we do that? We have to give them skills. We have to give them education, training. But there's a housing issue, there's drug abuse, there's mental health abuse, there's conflict resolution. And yes, there's the appreciation of life that we have to teach them, which is the exact culture change you hear me talking about.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Michael Harrison joins me today here in Studio A. We'll have more with the commissioner after a quick break. We will try to get to some more of our calls and emails. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Commissioner and listeners, before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence during the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far in 2019, 186 people in Baltimore City have been victims of homicide. Police have released the identities of four homicide victims whose deaths were first reported the week before last. They are Wayne Phillips, age 24, Juwan Valines, age 21, Frank McNeil, age 64, and Travis Chance. He was 16 years old. Alan Downer was shot 33 years ago, first in June of 1986 and then again in September of that year. He died last month due to complications from the injuries he sustained in those shootings, and last week, the city's medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. Alan Downer was 61. Baltimore police have reported that 9 people lost their lives to violence in our city last week. The identity of one of those people has not yet been released. The others are Antone Chantel Suggs, age 33, Kalee Tyree, age 22, Charles Falk, age 22, Antoine Gordon, age 33, David Caldwell, age 52, Brandon Cobb, age 26, Jaquan Johnson, age 22, and Dante Webb. He was 17 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
In case you didn't know. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the commissioner of the Baltimore City Police Department, Michael Harrison. He was sworn in March after a nearly 28-year career with the New Orleans Police Department, including 4 years leading the NOPD. He is the 5th Baltimore Police Commissioner in our city in the last 4 years. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Commissioner Harrison, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to Andre in Northwest Baltimore, who's been patient on the phone. Andre, welcome to the show with Commissioner Harrison.
Thank you for taking my call. Commissioner, I just want to know this question here, that every time, you know, in the previous situations, you've seen the mayor, the state's attorney, and the police commissioner, but you never see the sheriff, who's an elected official, and he's been around 30 years. I would like to know, what's your working relationship, if any, with him, and why is he never at the press conference when you're talking about a plan to curb crime in the city? And then the other question quickly, I was with 4 of your officers in the Northwest District on Thursday, and there was crime, drug activity, and I pointed it out to them, and they refused to do anything about it. You know, so, you know, this open drug air market is still real, and these officers are refusing to even engage these drug dealers. And they seem actually drug deals go down.
All right. Thanks for the call, Andre.
Thank you, not an
uncommon complaint, sir.
No, I've heard that complaint many, many times, going back to my first day here in Baltimore. So I've met the sheriff, and we've met in his office, and we've met a couple of times. And the primary duty for the sheriff, I believe, if I'm correct, is security for the courtrooms. And there is some room for them to partner with us in the field, but due to manpower constraints on their end, they're suffering from the same very thing. The primary duty is for courtroom security and not necessarily for urban policing out in the city. But there is communication and there is partnerships for them to help to some degree in some areas. But when it comes to the day-to-day operations of policing, you normally see is by and large the police department. And so that kind of little bit, I think, answers the question about why we do what we do at press conferences. But when it comes to the open air drug market, certainly I've heard that complaint. And I am constantly working with the leadership of our department to educate our members of our department on how to engage in the appropriate way and how to do it safely, how to do it in a constitutional way, but to solve the problem. And many times the uniform officers are actually answering the citizens' calls and going from call to call. But many times they're in a single-person car, in a vehicle by themselves, and are not in a position to make an approach where there's multiple people. And sometimes we just are not in a position to do that. Now, that's no excuse. We have to be able to, as a department, address the open-air drug markets. And it is happening. But we're doing
it. Does the microzone thing, you know,
the microzones thing, I think, will help deter it and push it away and displace it and push it away. I think the caller is talking about us engaging them, mm-hmm. and the lack of engagement. And what is happening that you don't see is a lot of that happening from a covert and surveillance and undercover capacity. Because we're making quite a few drug arrests and we're taking down a number of drug markets, but it is not the uniform officer that's doing it. A lot of times some of our uniform officers are stopping them, but a lot of the success around the city, and we see it every day, some of it we even come to the community in a press conference telling you what we did and who we took down. It's really our covert and undercover and surveillance teams that are putting a dent into that. That's often not seen.
Number of comments about the consent decree. Rich says, you know, can you ask the commissioner about the consent decree and what's the impact on policing and violent crime? Ben, Mark says, is it codified within police policy and procedures that officers are required to report any misconduct on duty by other officers? As I said, when I talk to cops on the street, they're not happy to talk about the consent decree. Most of them say, you know, it ties our hands.
Well, you know, I've experienced that now in two cities. The cops said that in New Orleans. But there will be an evolution where the messaging will be different. It is not that the consent decree ties our hands. The consent decree is a process improvement plan that improves efficiency and effectiveness and brings us into constitutional policing. So it adds burdens to us, administrative burdens, because it makes us document and prove to the citizens that we're doing our job in a constitutional way. So it adds an enormous amount of administrative burdens to us. So it doesn't stop us from doing anything that we were doing before, and it doesn't stop us from doing anything that the law gives us the right to do. It just says you have to now prove that you're doing it in a legitimate and lawful way, which brings in documentation. So it slows us down. And it makes sure that when we talk about a constitutional way, making sure that the officers are competent and confident in the way we make these approaches. To the previous caller's point, engagement. How do we engage? What does that look like? How do we do it now in a constitutional way versus the way we were alleged to have done it that put us into a consent decree? So there's some confusion. And as we move through training, we're teaching the officers how to do that. And so we're moving well. And when it comes to reporting crime, you know, officers, we're required to report crimes that we see. So if we see a crime being committed, whether it's by a citizen or by our own officer, the same requirement exists.
The city council here in Baltimore meets tonight, as they do every Monday. Shannon Sneed, one of the councilwomen on the council, elected for the first time in the last election, is going to introduce legislation to eliminate gag orders, meaning that if a person settles a lawsuit with the police department, receives a financial compensation for whatever infraction the police admitted to or were found guilty of. They are not allowed to discuss it in public. Andre Davis, the city solicitor, is going to appeal that decision. A decision by a federal court, the Fourth Circuit, ruled 2-1 that they were the gag orders were not constitutional. Your feeling about gag orders and whether or not they, you know, if they were banned, would that impede the police? The capacity for the police to do their work.
Well, I have not, as a chief now, 5 years, have not experienced how that affects one way or another a police department. And so I think because that's a legal issue and it's in litigation, I think I just defer to, you know, to our city solicitor for that.
What can you point to as progress on the consent decree that's occurred so far? And what are your sort of short-term goals, you know, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, in terms of what will be accomplished according to the consent decree?
Good question. You know, the consent decree is broken down into a year plan, year one plan, year two plan, year three plan. Year one plan was about policy creation. And so though it looks like it's moving slow, it's actually moving quite well. We met with our judge last week. Spent a few hours, who was impressed with at least what we've done so far. And so it was about policy creation. This year, too, we're on track and on target. It's about training to the policies in addition to more policy creation. And so we're moving the entire department right now through the newest use of force training. And then in the last part of the year, it'll be stops, searches, and arrests. And so by the end of the year, we will have trained all of our members in constitutional policing regarding uses of force, stops, searches, and arrests. And so we're on track right now, but it is about unlearning bad behavior and learning good behavior by implementing the newest best practice policies and then the newest best practice training so that we can demonstrate the actual practice in the field. And I said, I think we're on task and on target, but as technology comes in that we need so badly, moving out of paper into a digital environment, we really can become a more robust department and really create a high-level auditing function within the department to really show you how we're moving with the consent decree. Because now auditing means going through papers to really find out what we're doing and if we're doing it well.
Just got a couple minutes left. Yes. Given the difficulties of recruitment, given the difficulties in personnel shortages, the status of overtime, this is something that you've thought a lot about. It's been very expensive to the city over the years.
Yes, it has. And we see a lot of areas of improvement where we can just become better managers and stewards over our overtime, what it is used for. First of all, creating performance metric goals, assigning those to the overtime. And then what we found is that officers were working overtime to fill shortages and for crime suppression initiatives, but no one was asking permission to do it and no one was granting permission and it wasn't being tracked. And we were learning about it after the fact. So just creating a policy on it and creating performance metrics and accountability measures for officers and supervisors and commanders to know in advance who's working, to know in advance who's reaching the limit, and to create a limit so that we can make sure our officers remain mentally and physically fit in our officer wellness program, that they're able to do their jobs at a high level. And creating standards of operation and accountability measures to know who's working, when they're working, why they're working, and is it justifiable for them to actually be working it. And I think that alone will help us understand how to bring it down to minimize any fraud, waste, and abuse that we know is occurring with overtime. But it is really about accountability-driven leadership.
Let me sneak in one more question. We only got 20 seconds
yes.
left. But when you were hired, a lot of folks pointed to the similarities between New Orleans and Baltimore in terms of the department, the makeup of the city, the problems. What's different about Baltimore than New Orleans?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a bigger department. And I think right now, the difference is we're creating policies that either weren't there or were there and not enforced. And there's a culture here where commissioners weren't really stepping up and shaping the culture that we need to be abiding by best practices.
It's good to see you, sir, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
Commissioner Michael Harrison of the Baltimore City Police Department. We've got a link to the commissioner's crime reduction and departmental transformation plan on our website. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a conversation about race and racism in the era of President Donald Trump, who regularly fans the flames of racial animus at rallies and in multiple public and private comments. We'll be joined by, among others, Baruti Capano from Morgan State University, and we'll take your calls and comments about the racial animus so much in display on so many occasions here in America. Thanks to The Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.